the last calm you passed, along with the peat. Now he's got good, sturdy walking boots and good thick socks, 2 full changes of clothing and a jacket that's remarkably similar to your own. Apart from his bizarre looks, the matching garb makes you look like you're together. That sort of thing sends unspoken messages of organization, shared focus, group membership. It's not much, but every little deterrent helps. Such a formidable pair we are, crazy woman and changeling child. Come on, you say, and start walking. He follows. It's quiet as you approach the roadhouse. You can tell you're close by the disturbances in the meadow. Here's someone's abandoned campsite with still smoldering fire. There's someone's torn runny sack, trailed by supplies grabbed and dropped in flight. There's a ring of pulled grass, campfire coals, and an abandoned bedroll that might have been yours. You scoop it up in passing and roll it up, jabbing it through the straps of your sack to tie properly later. And then, sooner than you were expecting, there is the roadhouse itself. You think at first there's no one here. You can't hear anything but your own footsteps and your breath. The boy is mostly silent, but his footsteps are oddly heavy against the asphalt when you step back onto the road. You glance at him, and he seems to realize it. He stops, looking intently at your feet as you keep walking, watching how you roll from heel to toes, not so much planting a step as peeling your feet off the ground and carefully reapplying them. Then he begins doing the same thing, and if you didn't need to pay attention to your surroundings, if you weren't distracted by the racing of your own heart, you would laugh at the surprise on his little face when his own footfalls become silent. He's almost cute. But that's when you step into the roadhouse and realize you're not alone. First, you notice just the pump and the cement casing it's set into. That's really all the roadhouse is, a shelter for the pump. Then you see a woman, who is humming to herself as she pulls away one large canteen and sets another empty and even larger in its place beneath the spigot. She bustles around the casing to work the pump mechanism, busy as you please, and only sees you after she started working the lever again. Then she freezes, and you and she stare at each other. She's calmless. No one who's suffered only recent homelessness would be so filthy. Except the boy. A part of your mind supplies. But there's a difference between disaster filth and unwashed filth. This woman's hair is matted, not in clean, well-groomed locks like yours, but from sheer neglect. It hangs in moldy, uneven clumps from her head. Her skin isn't just covered in dirt. The dirt is ground in, a permanent fixture. There's iron ore in some of it, and it's rusted from the moisture in her skin, tinting the pattern of her pores red. Some of her clothes are fresh, given how much you saw abandoned around the roadhouse. Easy to guess where she got those. And the pack at her feet is one of 3. Each one fat with supplies and dangling an already filled canteen. But her body odor is so high and ripe that you hope she's taking all that water to use for a bath. Her eyes flick over you and Hoa, assessing just as quickly and thoroughly. And then, after a moment, she shrugs a little and finishes pumping, filling the large canteen in 2 strokes. Then she takes it, caps it, attaches it again to one of the big packs at her feet, and, so deftly that you're a little awed, scoops up all 3 and scuttles back. Have at. You've seen calmness before, of course. Everyone has. In cities that want cheaper labor than strongbacks, and where the strongbacks union is weak, they live in shanty towns and beg on the streets. Everywhere else they live in the spaces between calms. Forests and the edges of deserts and such, where they survive by hunting game and building encampments out of scraps. The ones who don't want trouble raid fields and silos on the outskirts of calm territories. The ones who like a fight raid small, poorly defended calms and attack travelers along the lesser Quartant roads. Quartant governors don't mind a little of this. Keeps everyone sharp and reminds troublemakers of how they could end up. Too many thefts, though, or too violent an attack, and militias get sent out to hunt the calmless down. None of that matters now. We don't want any trouble, you say. We're just here for water, same as you. The woman, who's been looking with curiosity at Hoa, flicks her gaze back to you. Not like I'm starting any. Rather deliberately, she caps another canteen she's filled. Got more of these to fill, though, so... She jerks her chin at your pack and the canteen dangling from it. Yours won't take long. Hers are truly huge. They're also probably heavy as logs. Are you waiting for others to come? Nope. The woman grins, flashing remarkably good teeth. If she's calmless now, she didn't start out that way. Those gums haven't known much malnutrition. Gonna kill me? You have to admit, you weren't expecting that. She must have some place nearby, Hoa says. You're pleased to see that he's at the door looking outward, still on guard. Smart boy. Yep, says the woman, cheerfully unperturbed that they have sussed out her ostensible secret. Gonna follow me? No, you say firmly. We're not interested in you. Leave us be, and we'll do the same. Solid by me. You unsling your canteen and edge over to the pump. It's awkward. The thing is meant to be worked by one person, while another holds a container. The woman puts a hand on the pump, silently offering. You nod, and she pumps for you. You drink your fill first, and then there's tense silence while the canteen fills. Nerves make you break it. You took a big risk coming here. Everyone else is probably coming back soon. A few, and not soon. And you took the same big risk. True. So. The woman nods toward her pile of filled canteens, and belatedly you see. What is that? Atop one of the canteen's mouths is some kind of little contraption made of sticks, twisted leaves, and a piece of crooked wire. It clicks softly as you stare. Running a test, anyway. What? She shrugs, eyeing you, and you realize it then. This woman is no more an ordinary calmless than you are a still. That shake from the north, she says. It was at least a niner. And that was just what we felt on the surface. It was deep, too. She pauses abruptly, actually cocking her head away from you and frowning, as if she's heard something startling. Though there's nothing there but the wall. Never seen a shake like that. Weird wave pattern to it. Then she focuses on you again, bird quick. Probably breached a lot of aquifers. They'll repair themselves over time, of course. But in the short term, no telling what kinds of contaminants might be around here. I mean, this is perfect land for a city, right? Flat, ready access to water, nowhere near a fault. Means there probably was one here at some point. You know what kinds of nasty things cities leave behind when they die? You're staring at her now. Hoa is too, but he stares at everyone like that. Then the thing in the canteen finishes clicking, and the calmless woman bends over to pluck it free. It had been dangling a strip of something, tree bark, into the water. Safe, she proclaims, and then belatedly seems to notice you staring. She frowns a little and holds up the little strip. It's made from the same plant as Safe. You know, the greeting tea. But I treated it with a little something extra to catch those substances Safe doesn't catch. There's nothing, you blurt. And then you fall silent, uneasy, when she focuses sharply on you. Now you have to finish. I mean, there's nothing Safe misses that would hurt people. That's the only reason anyone drinks it, because it tastes like boiled ass. Now the woman looks annoyed. That's not true. Where the rust did you learn that? It's something you used to teach in the Turimo crash. But before you can say this, she snaps. Safe doesn't work as well if it's in a cold solution. Everybody knows that. Needs to be room temperature or lukewarm. It also doesn't catch things that kill you in a few months instead of a few minutes. Fat lot of good it'll do you to survive the day, only to come down with skin peel next year. You're a geomist, you blurt. It seems impossible. You've met geomasts. They're everything people think origins are when they're feeling charitable. Arcane, unfathomable, possessed of knowledge no mortal should have. Disturbing. No one but a geomast would know so many useless facts so thoroughly. I am not. The woman draws herself up, almost swelling in her fury. I know better than to pay attention to those fools at the university. I'm not stupid. You stare again in utter confusion. Then your canteen overflows, and you scramble to find the cap for it. She stops pumping, then tucks the little bark contraption into a pocket among her voluminous skirts, and starts to disassemble one of the smaller packs at her feet, her movements brisk and efficient. She pulls free a canteen the same size as yours and tosses it aside. Then when the small pack's empty, she tosses that aside too. Your eyes lock onto both items. It would be easier on you if the boy could carry his own supplies. You'd better grab if you're going to, the woman says. And though she's not looking at you, you realize she intentionally set the items out for you. I'm not staying, and you shouldn't either. You edge over to take the canteen and the empty small pack. The woman stands again to help you fill the new canteen before resuming her rummaging through her own stuff. While you tie on your canteen and the bedroll you grabbed earlier and transfer a few items from your pack into the smaller one for the boy, you say, "Do you know what happened? Who did what?" You gesture vaguely in the direction of the screams that woke you up. I doubt it was a who, the woman says. She tosses away several packets of gone-off food, a child's set of pants that might be big enough for Hoa, and books. Who puts books in a runny sack? Though the woman glances at the title of each before throwing it aside. People don't react as quickly as nature to changes like this. You attach the second canteen to your own pack, for now, since you know better than to make Hoa carry too much weight. He's just a boy, and a poorly grown one at that. Since the calmless woman clearly doesn't want them, you also pick up the pants from the small pile of discards that's growing beside her. She doesn't seem to care. You ask, "What? You mean that was some kind of animal attack? Didn't you see the body?" "Didn't know there was a body. People screamed and started running, so we did too." The woman sighs. "Well, that's not unwise, but it does lose you opportunities." As if to illustrate her point, she tosses aside another pack that she's just emptied and stands, shouldering the two that remain. One of them is more worn and obviously comfortable than the other, her own. She's used twine to lash the heavy canteens together so that they nestle against the small of her back, supported by the not-insubstantial curve of her ass, rather than hanging as most canteens do. Abruptly, she glowers at you.
Don't follow me.
Wasn't planning to. The small pack's ready to be given to Hoa. You strap on your own. Check to make sure everything's secure and comfy.
I mean it.
She leans forward a little, her whole face almost feral in its fierceness.
You don't know what I'm going back to. I could live in a walled compound with 50 other rusters just like me. We might have tooth files in a juicy, stupid people recipe book.
Okay, okay. You take a step back, which seems to mollify her. Now she goes from fierce to relaxed and resumes settling her packs for comfort. You've got what you want to, so it's time to get out of here. The boy looks pleased by his new pack when you hand it to him. You help him put it on properly. As you do this, the calmless woman passes you to leave, and some vestige of your old self makes you say, "Thanks, by the way."
"Anytime," she says airily, heading through the door,
and abruptly she stops. She's staring at something. The look on her face makes all the hairs on the back of your neck prickle. Quickly you go to the door as well to see what she's seeing. It's a Krakuza, one of the long-bodied, furry creatures Midladders keep as pets instead of dogs, since dogs are too expensive for anyone except the most ostentatious equatorials. Krakuza look more like big, land-bound otters than canines. They're trainable, cheap as anything because they eat only the leaves of low bushes and the insects that grow on them. And they're even cuter than puppies when they're small. But this Krakuza isn't cute. It's big, a good 100 pounds of healthy, sleek-furred flesh. Someone's loved it dearly, at least until lately. That's a fine leather collar still round its neck. It's growling, and as it slinks out of the grass and up onto the road, you see red blooms in the fur around its mouth and on its clawed, prehensile paws. That's the problem with Krakuza, see? The reason everybody can afford them. They eat leaves, until they taste enough ash, which triggers some instinct within them that's normally dormant. Then they change. Everything changes during a season. "Shit," you whisper. The calmless woman hisses beside you, and you tense, feeling your awareness descend briefly into the earth. You drag it back out of habit, not around other people. Not unless you have no other choice. She's moved to the edge of the asphalt, where she was probably about to bolt into the meadow and toward a distant stand of trees. But not far from the road, around the place where people screamed earlier, you see the grass moving violently and hear the soft huffs and squeals of other Krakuza. How many? You can't tell. They're busy, though. Eating. This one used to be a pet. Maybe it remembers its human master fondly. Maybe it hesitated when the others attacked and failed to earn more than a taste of the meat that will be its new staple diet until the season ends. Now it will go hungry if it doesn't rethink its civilized ways. It pads back and forth on the asphalt, chittering to itself as if in indecision. But it doesn't leave. It's got you and Hoa and the calmless woman boxed in, while it wrestles with its conscience. Poor, poor thing. You set your feet and murmur to Hoa, and the woman if she feels like listening, "Don't move." But before you can find something harmless to latch on to, a rock inclusion you can shift, or a water source you can geyser that will give you an excuse to snatch the warmth from the air and the life from this overgrown squirrel, Hoa glances at you and steps forward. "I said," you begin, grabbing his shoulder to yank him back. But he doesn't yank. It's like trying to move a rock that's wearing a jacket. Your hand just slips off the leather. Underneath it, he doesn't move at all. The protest dies in your mouth as the boy continues to move forward. He's not simply being disobedient, you realize. There's too much purpose in his posture. You're not sure he even noticed your attempt to stop him. And then the boy is facing the creature a few feet away. It stopped prowling and stands tensed as if... Wait. What? Not as if it's going to attack? It lowers its head and twitches its stubby tail once, uncertainly, defensively. The boy's back is to you. You can't see his face, but all at once his stocky little frame seems less little and less harmless. He lifts a hand and extends it toward the kakuza, as if offering it to sniff, as if it's still a pet. The kakuza attacks. It's fast. They're quick animals anyway. But you see the twitch of its muscles, and then it's 5 feet closer, its mouth is open, and its teeth have closed around the boy's hand up to the middle of his forearm. And, oh, Earth, you can't watch this. A child dying in front of you as Uche did not. How could you let either happen? You are the worst person in the whole world. But maybe, if you concentrate, ice the animal and not the boy. You lower your gaze to try to concentrate as the calmless woman gasps and the boy's blood splatters the asphalt. Watching Hoa's mauling will make it harder. What matters is saving his life, even if he loses the arm, but then... Silence falls. You look up. The kakuza has stopped moving. It's still where it was, teeth locked on Hoa's arm, its eyes wild with something that is more fear than fury. It's even shaking faintly. You hear it make the most fleeting of aborted sounds, just a hollow squeal. Then the kakuza's fur starts to move. What? You frown. Squint. But it's easy to see, close as the beast is. Each individual hair of its fur waggles, seemingly in a different direction all at the same time. Then it shimmers. What? Stiffens. All at once you realize that not only are its muscles stiff, but the flesh that covers them is stiff too. Not just stiff, but solid. And then you notice the whole kakuza is solid. What? You don't understand what you're seeing, so you keep staring, comprehending in pieces. Its eyes have become glass, its claws crystal, its teeth some sort of ochre filament. Where there was movement, now there is stillness. Its muscles are rock hard, and that is not a metaphor. Its fur was just the last part of its body to change, twisting about as the follicles underneath transformed into... something else. You and the calmless woman both stare. Wow. Really? That's what you're thinking. You've got nothing better. Wow. That's enough to get you moving, at least. You edge forward until you can see the whole tableau from a better angle, but nothing really changes. The boy still seems fine, although his arm is still halfway down the thing's gullet. The kakuza is still pretty damn dead. Well, pretty and damn dead. Hoa glances at you, and all at once you realize how deeply unhappy he looks, like he's ashamed. Why? He's saved all of your lives, even if the method was... You don't know what this is. Did you do this? You ask him. He lowers his eyes. I hadn't meant for you to see this yet. Okay, that's something to think about later. What did you do? He presses his lips shut. Now he decides to sulk. But then, maybe now's not the time for this conversation, given that his arm is stuck in a glass monster's teeth. The teeth have pierced his skin, there's blood welling and dripping down, it's no longer flesh lower jaw. Your arm. Let me... You look around. Let me find something to break you out. Hoa seems to remember his arm, belatedly. He glances at you again, plainly not liking that you're watching, but then sighs a little in resignation, and he flexes his arm before you can warn him not to do anything that might wound him further. The Kirkuza's head shatters. Great chunks of heavy stone thud to the ground, glittering dust sprays. The boy's arm is bleeding more, but free. He flexes his fingers a little. They're fine. He lowers the arm to his side. You react to his wound, reaching for his arm because that is something you can comprehend and do something about. But he pulls away quickly, covering the marks with his other hand. Hoa, let me. I'm fine, he says quietly. We should go, though. The other Kukuza are still close, though they're busy chewing on some poor fool in the plains grass. That meal won't last them forever. Worse, it's only a matter of time before other desperate people make the choice to brave the roadhouse again, hoping the bad things have gone. One of the bad things is still right here, you think, looking at the Kirkuza's topless lower jaw. You can see the rough nodules on the back of its tongue, now gleaming in crystal. Then you turn to Hoa, who is holding his bloody arm and looking miserable. It's the misery, finally, that pushes the fear back down inside you, replaces it with something more familiar. Did he do this because he didn't know you could defend yourself? For some other unfathomable reason? In the end, it doesn't matter. You have no idea what to do with a monster who can turn living things into statuary. But you do know how to handle an unhappy child. Also, you have a lot of experience with children who are secretly monsters. So you offer your hand. Hoa looks surprised. He stares at it, then at you, and there is something in his gaze that is entirely human, and grateful for your acceptance in that moment. It makes you feel a little more human too, amazingly. He takes your hand. His grip seems no weaker despite his wounds. So you pull him along as you turn south and start walking again. The calmless woman wordlessly follows. Or maybe she's walking in the same direction. Or maybe she just thinks there's strength in numbers. None of you say anything, because there's nothing to say. Behind you in the meadow, the Kirkuza keep eating. Beware ground on loose rock. Beware hail strangers. Beware sudden silence. From Tablet 1. On Survival. Verse 3. 11. Damaya at the fulcrum of it all. There's an order to life in the fulcrum. Waking comes with dawn. Since that's what Damaya always did back on the farm, this is easy for her. For the other grits, and that's what she is now. An unimportant bit of rock, ready to be polished into usefulness, or at least to help grind other better rocks. Waking comes when one of the instructors enters the dormitory and rings a painfully loud bell, which makes them all flinch, even if they're already awake. Everyone groans, including Damaya. She likes this. It makes her feel like she's part of something. They rise and make their beds, folding the top sheets military style. Then they shuffle into the showers, which are white with electric lights and shining with tile, and which smell of herbal cleaners, because the fulcrum hires strong backs and calmless from humanist shanty towns to come and clean them. For this and other reasons, the showers are wonderful. She's never been able to use hot water every day like this, tons of it, just falling from holes in the ceiling like the most perfect rain ever. She tries not to be obvious about it, because some of the other grits are equatorials and would laugh at her. The bumpkin, overwhelmed by the novelty of easy, comfortable cleanliness. But, well, she is. After that, the grits brush their teeth and come back to the dormitory room to dress and groom themselves. Their uniforms are stiff gray fabric pants and tunics with black piping, girls and boys alike. Children whose hair is long and locked, or thin enough to be combed and pulled back, must do so. Children whose hair is ash blow, or kinky or short, must make sure it's shaped neatly. Then the grits stand in front of their beds, waiting while instructors come in and move down the rows for inspection. They want to make sure the grits are actually clean. The instructors check the beds, too, to make sure no one's peed in theirs or done a shoddy job of folding the corners. Grits who aren't clean are sent back for another shower, this one cold, with the instructor standing there watching to make sure it's done right. Demaya makes sure she'll never have to do this, because it doesn't sound fun at all. Grits who haven't dressed and groomed themselves or attended the bed properly are sent to discipline, where they receive punishments suited to the infraction. Uncombed hair gets cut very short. Repeat offenders are shaven bald. Unbrushed teeth merit mouthwashing with soap. Incorrect dress is corrected with 5 switches across the naked buttocks or back. Incorrect bed-making with 10. The switches do not break the skin. Instructors are trained to strike just enough. But they do leave welts, which are probably meant to chafe underneath the stiff fabric of the uniforms. "You are representatives of us all," the instructors say, if any grit dares to protest this treatment. "When you're dirty, all origins are dirty. When you're lazy, we're all lazy. We hurt you so you'll do the rest of us no harm." Once Demaya would have protested the unfairness of such judgments. The children of the fulcrum are all different. Different ages, different colors, different shapes. Some speak Sanzimat with different accents, having originated from different parts of the world. One girl has sharp teeth because it is her race's custom to file them. Another boy has no penis, though he stuffs a sock into his underwear after every shower. Another girl has rarely had regular meals and wolfs down every one like she's still starving. The instructors keep finding food hidden in and around her bed. They make her eat it, all of it, in front of them, even if it makes her sick. One cannot reasonably expect sameness out of so much difference, and it makes no sense for Demaya to be judged by the behavior of children who share nothing save the curse of orogeny with her. But Demaya understands, now that the world is not fair. They are origins, the misalems of the world, born cursed and terrible. This is what is necessary to make them safe. Anyway, if she does what she's supposed to, no unexpected things happen. Her bed is always perfect, her teeth clean and white. When she starts to forget what matters, she looks at her right hand, which twinges now and again on cold days, though the bones healed within a few weeks. She remembers the pain and the lesson that it taught. After inspection, there is breakfast. Just a bit of fruit and a piece of sausage in the Sanzed fashion, which they pick up in the dormitory foyer and eat on the way. They walk in small groups to lessons in the various courts of the fulcrum that the older grits call crucibles, though that's not what they're supposed to be called. There are many things the grits say to each other that they can never say to the adults. The adults know, but pretend they don't. The world is not fair, and sometimes it makes no sense. In the first crucible, which is roofed over, the first hours of the day are spent in chairs with a slate board and a lecture by one of the fulcrum's instructors. Sometimes there are oral examinations with questions peppered at the grits one by one until someone falters. The grit who falters will have to clean the slate boards. Thus do they learn to work calmly under pressure.
What was the name of the first Old Sansa Emperor?
A shake in Erta emits push waves at 6:35 and 7 seconds, and vibrational waves at 6:37 and 27 seconds.
What is the lag time?
This question becomes more complex if it is asked of older grits, going into logarithms and functions.
Stone lore advises, watch for the center of the circle. Where is the fallacy in this statement?
This is the question that lands on Demaya one day, so she stands to answer. The statement explains how one may estimate the location of an origin by map, she says.
It is incorrect, oversimplified.
Because an origin's region of consumption is not circular, it is toroidal. Many people then fail to understand that the zone of effect extends downward or upward as well, and can be deformed in other three-dimensional ways by a skilled origin. Instructor Markasite nods approval for this explanation, which makes Demaya feel proud. She likes being right.
Markasite continues. And since stone lore would be harder to remember if it was full of phrases like, watch for the inverted fulcrum of a conical torus, we get centers and circles. Accuracy is sacrificed in the name of better poetry.
This makes the class laugh. It's not that funny, but there's a lot of nervous tension on quiz days. After lectures, there is lunch in the big open-air court set aside for that purpose. This court has a roof of oiled canvas strips on slats, which can be rolled shut on rainy days, although Eumenes, which is far inland, rarely has such days. So the grits usually get to sit at long bench tables under a bright blue sky as they giggle and kick each other and call each other names. There's lots of food to make up for the light breakfast, all of it varied and delicious and rich, though much of it is from distant lands, and Demaya does not know what some of it is called. She eats her share anyway. Medir taught her never to waste food. This is Demaya's favorite time of day, even though she is one of the grits who sit alone at an empty table. Many of the other children do this, she has noticed. Too many to dismiss them all as those who failed to make friends. The others have a look to them that she is rapidly learning to recognize. A certain furtiveness of movement, a hesitancy, a tension about the eyes and jawline. Some of them bear the marks of their old lives in a more obvious way. There is a gray-haired Western Coaster boy who's missing an arm above the elbow, though he is deft enough at managing without it. A sunset girl, maybe 5 years older, has the twisting seams of old burn scars all down one side of her face. And then there is another grit, even newer than Demaya, whose left hand is in a special leather binding like a glove without fingers, which fastens around the wrist. Demaya recognizes this binding because she wore it herself while her hand healed during her first few weeks at the fulcrum. They do not look at each other much, she and these others who sit off to themselves. After lunch, the grits travel through the ring garden in long, silent lines, overseen by the instructors so that they will not talk or stare too obviously at the adult origins. Demaya does stare, of course, because they're supposed to. It's important that they see what awaits them once they begin earning rings. The garden is a wonder, as are the origins themselves. Adult and elderly of every conformation, all healthy and beautiful, confident, which makes them beautiful. All are starkly forbidding in their black uniforms and polished boots. Their ringed fingers flick and flash as they gesture freely, or turn the pages of books they don't have to read, or brush back a lover's curling hair from one ear. What Demaya sees in them is something she does not understand at first, though she wants it with a desperation that surprises and unnerves her. As those first weeks pass into months and she grows familiar with the routine, she begins to understand what it is that the older origins display. Control. They've mastered their power. No ringed origin would ice the courtyard just because some boy shoved her. None of these sleek, black-clad professionals would bat so much as an eyelash at either a strong earthquake or a family's rejection. They know what they are, and they have accepted all that means, and they fear nothing. Not the stills, not themselves, not even old man Earth. If to achieve this, Demaya must endure a few broken bones, or a few years in a place where no one loves or even likes her, that is a small price to pay. Thus, she pours herself into the afternoon training in applied orogeny. In the practice cubicles, which are situated within the innermost ring of the fulcrum complex, Demaya stands in a row with other grits of a similar level of experience. There, under an instructor's watchful gaze, she learns how to visualize and breathe, and to extend her awareness of the earth at will, and not merely in reaction to its movements or her own agitation. She learns to control her agitation and all the other emotions that can induce the power within her to react to a threat that does not exist. The grits have no fine control at this stage, so none of them are allowed to actually move anything. The instructors can tell somehow when they're about to, and because the instructors all have rings, they can pierce any child's developing torus in a way that Demaya does not yet understand, administering the quick, stunning slap of icy cold air as a warning. It is a reminder of the seriousness of the lesson, and it also lends credence to a rumor that the older grits have whispered in the dark after lights out. If you make too many mistakes in the lessons, the instructors ice you. It will be many years before Demaya understands that when the instructors kill an errant student, it is meant not as a goad, but as a mercy. After applied comes dinner and free hour, a time in which they may do what they please, allowed in deference to their youth. The newest grits usually fall into bed early, exhausted by the effort of learning to control invisible, semi-voluntary muscles. The older children have better stamina and more energy, so there's laughter and play around the dormitory bunks for a while, until the instructors declare lights out. The next day, it all begins again. Thus do 6 months pass. One of the older grits comes over to Demaya at lunch. The boy is tall and equatorial, though he doesn't look fully sonsed. His hair has the ashblow texture, but it's backwater blonde in color. He's got the broad shoulders and developing bulk of Strongback, which makes her wary at once. She still sees Zob everywhere. The boy smiles, though, and there is no menace in his manner as he stops beside the small table she inhabits alone. "Can I sit down?" She shrugs, because she doesn't want him to, but is curious despite herself. He puts down his tray and sits. "I'm Arkete," he says. "That's not your name," she replies, and his smile falters a little. "It's the name my parents gave me," he says more seriously, "and it's the name I intend to keep until they find a way to take it from me, which they'll never do because, well, you know, it's a name. But if you'd rather, I'm officially called Mashish." The highest quality grade of aquamarine, used almost exclusively for art. It suits him. He's a handsome boy, despite his obvious Arctic or Antarctic heritage. She doesn't care, but equatorials do. And that makes him dangerous in the sharp-faceted way that handsome big boys have always been. She decides to call him Mashish because of this. "What do you want?" "Wow,
You're really working on your popularity.
Mashish starts eating, resting his elbows on the table while he chews. But he checks to make sure there are no instructors around to chide him on his manners first.
You know how these things are supposed to work, right? The good-looking, popular guy suddenly shows interest in the mousy girl from the country. Everyone hates her for it, but she starts to gain confidence in herself. Then the guy betrays her and regrets it. It's awful, but afterwards she finds herself, realizes she doesn't need him, and maybe there's some other stuff that happens.
He waggles his fingers in the air.
And finally, she turns into the most beautiful girl ever because she likes herself. But it won't work at all if you don't stammer and blush and pretend you don't like me.
She's utterly confused by this salad of words. It annoys her so much that she says, "I don't like you."
Ouch.
He pantomimes being stabbed in the heart. In spite of herself, his antics do make Demaya relax a little. This makes him grin in turn.
Ah, that's better. What, don't you read books? Or didn't you have lorists in whatever mid-ladder hole you came from?
She doesn't read books, because she's not very good at reading yet. Her parents taught her enough to get by, and the instructors have assigned her a weekly regimen of additional reading to improve her skills in this area. But she's not about to admit that. Of course we had lorists. They taught us stone lore and told us how to prepare.
Ugh, you had real lorists.
The boy shakes his head.
Where I grew up, nobody listened to them except creche teachers and the most boring geomasts. What everybody liked instead were the pop lorists. You know, the kind who perform in amphitheaters and bars. Their stories don't teach anything. They're just fun.
Demaya has never heard of this, but maybe it's some equatorial fad that never made it to the Nomad Lats. But lorists tell stone lore. That's the whole point. If these people don't even do that, shouldn't they be called, I don't know, something else?
Maybe.
He shrugs and reaches over to steal a piece of cheese from her plate. She's so flustered by the pop lorist thing that she doesn't protest.
The real lorists have been complaining about them to the Umanescent leadership, but that's all I know about it.
They brought me here 2 years ago, and I haven't heard anything since. He sighs.
I hope the pop lorists don't go away, though. I like them even if their stories are a little stupid and predictable. Of course, their stories are set in real creches, not places like this.
His lips twitch down at the corners as he looks around at their surroundings in faint disapproval. Demaya knows full well what he means, but she wants to know if he'll say. Places like this? His eyes slide sidelong back to hers, flashing his teeth in a smile that probably charms more people than it alarms, he says.
Oh, you know. Beautiful, wonderful, perfect places full of love and light.
Demaya laughs, then stops herself. She's not sure why she did, either.
Yeah.
The boy resumes eating with relish.
Took me a while to laugh after I got here, too.
She likes him a little, after this statement. He doesn't want anything, she realizes after a time. He makes small talk and eats her food, which is all right since she was mostly finished anyway. He doesn't seem to mind when she calls him Mashish. She still doesn't trust him, but he just seems to want someone to talk with, which she can understand. Eventually he stands and thanks her
for this scintillating conversation,
which was almost entirely one-sided on his part, and then heads off to rejoin his friends. She puts it out of her mind and goes on about her day. Except, the next day something changes. It starts that morning in the shower, when someone bumps into her hard enough to make her drop her washcloth. When she looks around, none of the boys or girls sharing the shower with her look in her direction or apologize. She chalks it up to an accident. When she gets out of the shower, however, someone has stolen her shoes. They were with her clothes, which she'd prepared before the shower and laid out on her bed to speed up the process of getting dressed. She always does this, every morning. Now they're gone. She looks for them, methodically, trying to make sure she hasn't forgotten them somewhere, even though she knows she hasn't. And when she looks around at the other Grits, who are carefully not looking at her, as the instructors call inspection, and she can do nothing but stand there in her impeccable uniform and bare feet, she knows what's happening. She fails inspection and is punished with a scrub brushing, which leaves her soles raw and stinging for the rest of the day inside the new shoes they give her. This is only the beginning. That evening at dinner, someone puts something in the juice she is given with her meal. Grits with poor table manners are given kitchen duty, which means they have access to everyone's food. She forgets this and does not think about the odd taste of the juice until it becomes hard to focus and her head starts hurting. Even then she's not sure what's happening as she stumbles and lurches on her way back to the dormitory. One of the instructors pulls her aside, frowning at her lack of coordination and sniffs her breath. "How much have you had to drink?" the man asks. Demaya frowns, confused at first because she just had a regular-sized glass of juice. The reason it takes her a while to understand is that she's drunk. Someone has slipped alcohol into her juice. Origins aren't supposed to drink, ever. The power to move mountains plus inebriation equals disaster waiting to happen. The instructor who stopped Demaya is Galena, one of the younger four-ringers who runs the afternoon orogeny drills. He's merciless in the crucible, but for whatever reason he takes pity on her now. Galena takes her out of lineup and brings her to his own quarters, which are fortunately nearby. There he puts Demaya on a couch and commands her to sleep it off. In the morning, as Demaya drinks water and winces at the awful taste in her mouth, Galena sits her down and says, "You need to deal with this now. If any of the seniors had caught you..." He shakes his head. "It's an offense so severe that there's no standing punishment. It would be terrible. That's all either of them needs to understand." It doesn't matter why the other Grits have decided to bully her. All that matters is that they're doing it, and that these are no harmless pranks. They're trying to get her iced. Galena's right. Demaya's got to deal with this. Now. She decides she needs an ally. There's another girl among the loners that she's noticed. Everyone notices this girl. There's something wrong with her. Her orogeny is a precarious, pent thing, a dagger constantly poised to plunge into the earth, and training has only made it worse, because now the knife is sharper. That's not supposed to happen. Selu is her name, and she hasn't yet earned or been given an origin name, but the other Grits call her Crack to be funny, and that is the name that has stuck. She even answers to that name since she can't seem to stop them from using it. Everyone's already whispering that she won't make it, which means she's perfect. Demaya makes her move on Crack after breakfast the next day. She drinks only water now, which she has drawn from a nearby fountain. She has to eat the food they serve her, but she inspects it carefully before putting anything in her mouth. "Hi," she says, setting her tray down. Crack eyes her. "Really? Things are bad enough that you need me?" It's a good sign that they can be honest with each other right off. "Yes," Demaya says, and sits, since Crack hasn't really objected. "They're messing with you too, aren't they?" Of course they are. Demaya hasn't seen whatever they're doing, but it only makes sense. There's an order to life in the fulcrum. Crack sighs. This makes the room reverberate faintly, or so it feels for an instant. Demaya makes herself not react, because a good partnership should not begin with a display of fear. Crack sees this and relaxes, just a little. the judder of imminent disaster fades.
Yeah, Crack says softly.
Demaya realizes all of a sudden that Crack is angry, though she keeps her gaze on her plate. It's there in the way she holds her fork too tightly, and the way her expression is too blank. All at once, Demaya wonders, is Crack's control really a problem? Or is it simply that her tormentors have done their best to make her Crack?
So, what do you want to do about it?
Demaya outlines her plan. After an initial flinch, Crack realizes she is serious. They finish eating in silence, while Crack thinks it over. At last, Crack says, I'm in. The plan is really quite simple. They need to find the head of the serpent, and the best way to do that is to use bait. They decide on Mashish, because of course Mashish must be involved. Demaya's troubles began right after his ostensibly friendly overtures. They wait until he's in the shower one morning, laughing with his friends, and then Demaya returns to her bunk.
Where are my shoes? She asks loudly.
The other grits look around, some of them groan, all too ready to believe that bullies would be uncreative enough to pull the same trick twice. Jasper, who's only been in the fulcrum a few months longer than Demaya, scowls.
Nobody took your shoes this time, he says. They're in your trunk.
How do you know? Did you take them? Demaya moves to confront him, and he bristles and meets her in the middle of the room, his shoulders back with a front.
I didn't take your crap. If they're lost, you lost them.
I don't lose things.
She jabs him in the chest with a finger. He's a nomad ladder like her, but thin and pale, probably from some calm close to the Arctic. He turns red when he's angry. The other kids make fun of this, but not much, because he teases other kids more loudly. Good orogeny is deflection, not cessation.
If you didn't take them, then you know who did.
She jabs him again, and he swats her hand away.
Don't touch me, you stupid little pig. I'll break your rusting finger. What is this?
They all jump and fall silent and turn. In the doorway, ready to begin evening inspection, is Carnelian, one of the few seniors among the instructors. He's a big man, bearded and older and severe, with six rings. They're all afraid of him. In token of which, the grits immediately scramble into their places before the bunks, standing at attention. Demaya, in spite of herself, feels a bit of trepidation, until she catches Crack's eye, and Crack gives her a small nod. The distraction was enough.
I said, what is this?
Carnelian comes into the room once they're assembled. He focuses on Jasper, who's still apple red, though probably with fear rather than anger this time.
Is there some problem?
Jasper glares at Demaya.
Not with me, instructor.
When Carnelian turns to her, she is ready. Someone stole my shoes, instructor.
Again?
This is a good sign. Last time, Carnelian simply berated her for losing her own shoes and making excuses.
You have proof it was Jasper who stole them?
Here's the tricky part. She's never been good at lying. I know it was a boy. They disappeared during the last shower, and all the girls were in there with me. I counted. Carnelian sighs.
If you're trying to blame someone else for your shortcomings, she's always doing that, says a red-haired Eastern Coaster girl. She's got a lot of shortcomings, says a boy who looks like he comes from the same calm. If he's not a relative of hers outright.
Half the grits snicker.
Search the boys' chests.
Demaya speaks over their laughter. It's something she didn't ask for last time, because she wasn't sure where the shoes would be. This time she is sure.
There wasn't much time to get rid of the shoes. They have to still be here. Look in their chests. That's not fair,
says one tiny equatorial boy who looks barely old enough to be out of the toddler's crash.
No, it isn't, says Carnelian,
his scowl deepening as he looks at her.
Be very certain before you ask me to violate your fellow trainees' privacy. If you're wrong, we won't go eat.